Yamtov.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good afternoon. Contrary to defendants' claims, the appellate division ruling, and the so-called majority rule, this case is not just about defendants' singular act of leaving the scene of an accident under 2C11-5.1. It is also about an omission, that is, defendants' failure of complying with the requirements set forth in 39-4-129, most importantly, defendants' duty to render aid to each victim of the accident. And this is what the minority of state courts have focused on. For this court to rule in defendants' favor and affirm the panel's ruling and adopt the majority rule, this court would have to necessarily find that defendant owed a duty of aid to only one of the boys. That cannot be the legislature's intent, which is the most important factor. It's the paramount goal in giving effect to a statute.
Just stop right there for 1 second. Why is that so? If there are two victims or even three victims and aid is rendered to two, but not to the third, that would be a violation of the statute. Why does it necessarily have to result in multiple violations of the statute? Why is it a reasonable interpretation? Is you have to comply with every provision of the statute. If you don't, you violated it, but only once.
We're not saying that it's not a reasonable interpretation of the statute. What you're saying, if we look at the standards of statutory construction, the most important thing is to give effect to the legislature's intent. And yes, you look at the plain language, but you also look, and we're going to say that there is some ambiguity in the statute, no doubt, but it doesn't end there. Just because there's ambiguity and there's a reasonable interpretation, so to speak, that doesn't then, you know, the tie goes to the runner, that type of thing, in which the rule of lenity would apply. We also have to look at the language of the statute, the policy behind it, concepts of reasonableness, and like I said, the legislative history. Now, if there is ambiguity, that this court can then turn to extrinsic evidence, including, like I said, the legislative history, committee reports, but most important, contemporaneous construction. The contemporaneous construction comes from the other states which have analyzed this particular type of statute of knowingly leaving the scene of a crime where there's fatalities and or SBI. And in those cases, the majority of the states have focused on the use of the word any. The any, they said, is indeterminate. It can mean one, it could mean some, it could mean all. And in those cases, there's several of them, and I cite them in my brief, they actually say, well, it would be different. We would reach a different result if there was a definite article before the word person, such as a or the, and most importantly, another. Another is what our legislature has used. So when the word another is used, it shows that there is a duty. And that's what these minority of states have done. That, and I'm citing to Wisconsin and Texas, where they said that it's a policy call. They say that a duty is, it's victim driven and not scene driven. So if this court were to adopt this so-called majority rule, this would be, as far as I know, the first state which would have the word another in it, following the majority rule. So like I said, contemporaneous construction is part of the analysis. It doesn't just stop at plain language and reasonableness.
So Mr. Yamtov, tell me if I'm mistaken about the doctrine of contemporaneous construction, because I thought that contemporaneous construction is, there's a passage of a piece of legislation, let's say many years ago, there is an interpretation of the statute by the legislature. And then over a course of time, the legislature doesn't act, and the case finally comes up to our court. And it's the failure of the legislature to overrule the lower court that constitutes a contemporaneous construction. What you're arguing to us is that there's persuasive authority in other states. It's not the doctrine of contemporaneous construction, unless I'm mistaken. If I am, correct me.
I'm not in a position to correct, Your Honor, but I am. What I am saying is that, and if we want to go with persuasive authority, you would be creating an inconsistency in the overall construction of this type of statute that has been interpreted throughout the United States. And let me just point out another thing. I know I'm very much aware of the rule of lenity, but this court also has to avoid absurd results. What if one of the boys had survived the accident? We know that in this case, one of the boys was found brain dead and he died the next day. But what if he had survived? Does that mean that defendant gets a free pass in which he would not be charged with knowingly leaving the scene of an accident with a victim who suffered from SBI? Does that boy not count? Do we not even include his name in the indictment, and we just pick and choose the boy who died and not the boy who goes on suffering? It also leads to a paradox where a driver who has remained, and it gives the police the opportunity to determine the cause of the accident. And let's say that driver was impaired, either through drugs or alcohol, and there were multiple fatalities, that particular defendant is going to face multiple charges and receive separate punishments for each victim.
Mr. Yontef, I want to...
fled.
I'm sorry, finish your sentence.
The driver who fled would only be charged and punished for one offense. So defendant receives a windfall twice. One, he impedes the opportunity for the state to determine the cause of the accident. And two, he will only face a single charge.
I want to make sure I understood your first example of an absurd interpretation. Were you suggesting that the statute makes it a crime of the second degree if an accident takes place, there's an injury, and it does not result in death?
Well, then it falls under the assault statute.
Right. You were arguing some form of absurd result, and I'm just looking at the first paragraph of the statute, which I don't believe your example fits with.
Well, if there's two victims, one dies and one survives, but suffers from SBI, under the majority rule, the state would have to choose, obviously, the greater offense.
Make it simpler still. Let's assume there's one victim, okay, who does not die but otherwise suffers injury. Are they covered by the first paragraph of the statute by its plain terms?
No, they're not covered by 2C11-5.1. It's covered by 2C12-1.1, which is knowingly leaving the scene of an accident in which a victim suffers from SBI.
Right, but we're attempting to interpret 5.1.
Correct.
So you're trying to do so by referencing a result that would not bring it within the language of 5.1.
Well, I'm bringing it up because in these multi, very often, as we've seen in cases like Leapy, you have a variety of injuries, everything going from death down, you know, SBI down to, you know, just a what we would call a minor injury. And because of that there will be situations where if this court adopts the majority rule, then what is the state supposed to do in terms of charging? Is the is the second victim, since under the majority rule, if once the defendant leaves the scene of the accident, that's the crime which she's been charged with, the one where the person died. But what about the other victim who survived the crash and is now suffering from, you know, the effects of it and suffered SBI?
Now I understand your point.
Okay.
Are you suggesting you could get double punishment for that single accident? Much like in this case, where you could have a second degree charged under 5.1 and a third degree charged under 1.1 and a merger at the time of sentencing? Or are you suggesting they would both permit independent sentences?
I think you would need independent sentences on that, that there would be no merger, because the merger provision talks about, it wouldn't be the merger provision, it would be the consecutive sentence provision, because it's broader than the merger. And the merger only applies when you have a substantive charge of, say, manslaughter or vehicular homicide, or for the SBI be an aggravated assault.
So Mr. Yomtov,
yes.
Is an anti-merger provision, excuse me, within 2C11-5.1, correct?
Yes.
The legislature knew how to craft an anti-merger. They could have put the same language in with respect to multiple victims right there, but they didn't do it, correct?
Yes.
So you know, why shouldn't we consider that as indicating somehow the legislative will? Go ahead.
We look at the first provision of 2C11-5.1, and it says if the accident results in the death of another person. And then we go to the statutory construction that we've deemed to be persuasive authority. And another person means each person, essentially, each individual who has been killed in the accident. So that, and then you go down to the merger provision. The merger provision just says that if there is, because it actually says under the paragraph before that, if there's evidence to prove aggravated manslaughter or a form of vehicular homicide, that those offenses then would not merge with knowingly leaving the scene of an accident.
So looking at another person, this goes back to the issue of ambiguity. Is another person referring to motor vehicle operator? Would it be any different if it said any person? You're saying it means each person with reference to, it's difficult to figure that out just from looking at the language of the statute. Would you agree?
I would agree if we were looking at this in a vacuum, but we're not. We actually have persuasive authority, which gets into the weeds of this issue, which says—
Mr. Yomtov, even if we, so you, both you and Ms. Campbell have referred back to, of course, Title 39. Title 39 uses any person. So in not looking at this in a vacuum, how do you square your argument where you're all in on the word another with the fact that the statute that is being cross-referenced in 5.1 uses the term any person?
The only thing that I could surmise with 39.4-129 subsection C is the beginning of it does refer to, as Your Honor pointed out, to injury or death to any person. But later on, when you get to the actual duties that are owed, it does use more specific language, such as render to a person injured in the accident, including carrying of that person to a hospital, if it is apparent that the treatment is necessary or is requested by the injured person. So that would mean that the duty would be owed to the multiple victims of the offense.
The only thing that I can say in this section, so here in Title 39, we should disregard the use of any in subsection A and disregard the use of any in subsection C.
I'll be honest.
Later, the term that is used, and going to Justice Alvin's point, it's not very clear. You know, we're not looking at it in a vacuum. It's not very clear. The term another is used in 5.1, cross-reference to Title 39, and we see any that. It's hard to say that it's very clear and using the authority from other states to shed light on what our legislature meant in using these different terms throughout these two statutes. Wouldn't you agree?
No, because what I think happened is that this statute actually tried to find the origins of 4-129, and the case law talks about amendments going as far back as the 1920s. So it is possible that language regard to injury or death to any person just carried over. But when it came to really describing the duties that are owed, it used the more specific language of, like I said, using the articles the, and that, which I think is an adjective. But most important is the language in the statute which criminalized the hit and runs, Title 39, which is 2C11-5.1. It uses the specific word another person who has been killed in the accident. And in terms of the persuasive authority, I'll cite you to my brief. It's on pages 26 and 27, 28, 29, 30. So there's a lot of, 31, I think. So there's a lot of case law on this subject. And when you look at these cases, they get into the difference between the use of the word any, which is ambiguous, which is indefinite, and they compare it to another, which is definite. And from that, the courts ascertain the legislature's intent with respect to whether it's scene-driven versus accident-driven. Now, with one caveat, the Wisconsin case of Powell, that's the Wisconsin Supreme Court case, they actually use the word any. But based on the policy of their state, as well as theirs is kind of bifurcated, which is similar to ours, it uses the word any in describing the scenario that the person presents himself. But in the penalty section, it uses the article in an intermediate appellate case for Wisconsin, they said that was a significant difference. And that it was victim driven rather than scene driven.
Is there anything you'd like to add to your presentation, Mr. Yompton?
I'm just looking over my notes here. No, I think that's pretty much it. I just urge the court to, when it looks at this, and that it's not just there's a singular act here. There is an omission, which is tied to the duty to render aid and assistance to each victim, and that it will create these anomalies if the majority rule is adopted. And there's no further questions. I'll
rest. Thank you. Ms. Romeo.
Yes, Chief Justice, Your Honors, may please the court. I had requested a 5-minute opening, but with your permission, I'll just proceed directly into my argument.
Go right ahead.
Your Honors, the state has argued that you should focus on whether the leaving statute uses the word any, another person to determine whether or not a person who violates New Jersey's leaving statute can be convicted of multiple offenses based on the number of victims. But it's very clear when you look at the universe of state statutes that that language is not at all dispositive of anything. Some of the statutes where the state appellate courts have found that the rule of multiplicity was violated, they use the word or another. I would point the court to the Indiana statute Neal v. State, which is cited in my appellate brief. That is 677 any second 79. I would point the court to the Nevada statute in Firestone, Nevada v. Firestone, which is cited in the appellate division decision. That is at 83 P3rd 279. Both of those statutes use the word, the singular word A. But all of these courts and some of the statutes that are considered by the courts include a rendering aid provision right in the statute. Some of them don't include a rendering aid provision. Some of them use the words injury or death right in the statute. Some of them have separate sections of the same statute. Some of them have different statutes. But all of those courts determined, and it is the overwhelming majority, that a person can be convicted only of a single offense for leaving the scene of a single accident. And the reason for that is because there is no fault component in these statutes. It is not an element of the offense that the person have caused the accident. And what that means is that Mr. Bell had been sitting at a stoplight at the bottom of that hill and been broadsided by this bicycle with the way he was. And if he got up and ran, he would still be just as guilty. The state is urging you to impose an interpretation on this statute that would repeatedly lead to absurd results. For example, if a person is sitting at a stoplight, a red light, and a drunken bus driver with 20 passengers blows through a stop sign and hits that car, and those 20 passengers die, and the person who was sitting at the stoplight runs away, according to the state's interpretation, that the person who ran away would be facing 25-year terms despite having had no responsibility for the accident. There's no fault component in this statute. Any fault of the fleeing driver is assessed and punished according to where it belongs in the homicide or the assault provisions, aggravated manslaughter, reckless strict liability manslaughter, or in the case of injury, aggravated assault or assault by auto. And Your Honors, as you have recognized many times, that in order to determine whether or not a particular prosecution or a type of prosecution violates the rule of multiplicity, we have to look to the rules of statutory interpretation and the plain rule, the plain language of the statute. And we've already discussed, I've spoken about the fact that there's no fault component, but there's other aspects of this language in the statute that I believe we should look at. The statute was passed as part one of a two-part act, chapter 111 of the laws of 1997. The two sections have identical formats. The first paragraph sets forth the element of the crime, the predicates for prosecution, that the motor vehicle operator knows he's involved in an accident, knowingly leaves the scene of the accident under circumstances that violate the provision of NJSA 39-4-129, that the person at the time would be guilty of a third degree crime if the accident results in the death of another person. Or in the second part of that same act is the 2C colon 12 provision or serious bodily injury. But otherwise, those two paragraphs are identical. The second paragraph, they are also identical. They provide that a conviction under this statute does not preclude a conviction for aggravated manslaughter, reckless. In the original statute, it was aggravated manslaughter, vehicular homicide. In other words, when a person who's convicted under this statute is also at fault for the accident, if they are at fault, he or she cannot claim double jeopardy protections preclude a conviction for the injuries that the that his actions caused when that person is at fault. That the same provision is in paragraph 2 of the second part of the act. And then the third paragraph contains the anti-merger provision, that when there's additional homicide or assault convictions, those convictions shall not merge. And I'd ask the court to look, this is again in the chapter 11, the original enactment that passed these two statutes. In paragraph 3 of the first part, it says in the anti-merger provision that the conviction shall not merge, and a separate sentence shall be imposed upon each such conviction. Then we get to paragraph 4 of both parts of the same act. In paragraph 4 of the 2C11, which is section 1 of the first act, we see that a phrase that says, when the court imposes multiple sentences of imprisonment for more than one offense, those sentences shall run consecutively. In section 2 of the same act, regarding the 2C12 provision, there is an additional explanatory phrase inserted in there. And it says, whenever in the case of such multiple convictions, the court imposes multiple sentences of imprisonment for more than one offense, those sentences shall run consecutively. So it continues with the exact same language. It is not logical that the legislature follow the exact same format in parts 1 and 2 of the statute, and then it intended a completely different meaning to be ascribed to the paragraph 4 of the second part of the act. It is logical that the legislature may have intended this provision of such multiple convictions to refer back to the previous language. The language of the legislature recognizes that a person's factual and legal culpability for the injuries suffered by the victims is entirely distinct from their culpability for violating this statute by leaving the scene of a single accident. And the punishment for actually causing the injuries or death has to be based on the severity of the harm and has to be based on the number of victims, and it has to be accounted for in the manslaughter and assault provisions of the separate acts, separate statutes. Your Honor, I would just respond to the concept that if we have a situation where one person survived and one person was injured, that somehow or another there would be a situation where one person's injuries were not accounted for or they were not vindicated. I would say that if we're in a situation where there's one car, one person dies and one person's injured, we are at the level of the second degree crime. That then creates the circumstance that we're at the predicate of the second degree crime. And that's where this particular act would be punished. And if the person was at fault, then the act, the fault pertaining to the person who was injured and the fault pertaining to the person who died would be accounted for in the separate homicide or assault statutes as appropriate. Your Honor, to respond to the state's, Your Honors, do you have any questions on this issue, or would you like me to discuss the other issue? Your Honor, let me be very clear that there was no resentencing here and there was no windfall to the state. There was only one issue on appeal, whether or not the trial court erred when it denied the motion to dismiss. The cases relied on by the state are all inapposite because they all involve appeals by the defendant after a jury trial. And that is a critical distinction. When a defendant pleads guilty, he waives his right to a jury trial, the right to avoid self-incrimination, the right to confront his accusers, the right to have his guilt proven beyond a reasonable doubt. that waiver remains in effect even after he wins his appeal. The concept here that there was no meeting of the minds is directly belied by the black and white words of the plea agreement. Both parties knew the terms of the agreement. It was very clear the state agreed it would make certain sentencing recommendations, knowing that the defendant intended to appeal the dismissal motion. The defendant pled guilty, the state made the recommendation, the court accepted the plea, sentenced him, and the defendant appealed. Now the state is seeking a post-plea, post-sentencing, post-appeal withdrawal from a plea agreement, and there is no basis in the law for it to do so.
Well, why isn't the logic of Hess applicable here, where you had a plea agreement, part of it was voided, and the case was then sent back. The plea was vacated, and we started anew. Why isn't that the appropriate course here?
In a situation where, Your Honor, I'm not pulling the facts of Hess right now to my mind, to be honest. But when there's a situation where
I missed what you just said. You said, Your Honor, I'm not pulling
the facts of Hess to my mind.
Thank you.
Let me help you a little bit, if I could. I believe Hess involved a situation where the defense attorney was barred under the plea agreement for arguing for a lesser sentence. And the court said unacceptable.
Yes.
We go back and we do it again.
Yes. And that was a very unique situation there. When the court determined that's simply not an acceptable way to conduct plea agreements and sentencing. In that particular situation,
and if I could, that there was no meeting of the minds. That was part of the analysis as well. The parties settled on an agreement. Part of it was invalidated. Much like in this situation here, if your first argument prevails, why is there still a meeting of the minds that doesn't call for invalidation of the plea and a return to the trial court to start again?
Well, Your Honors, because there was a determination that the actual plea process in that situation had essentially an illegal component to it. That is not the case here. And if, for example, this was an illegal sentence, yes, then it could be voided and we could go back again because an illegal sentence can be corrected at any time. But that's not what happened here.
You're arguing this is an illegal second count based on multiplicity, the law, the doctrine relating to multiplicity, no?
Your Honor, I'm arguing that the trial court erred when he failed to dismiss the second count. If we had been back in that back in the beginning and they had dismissed the second count and the state could have asked for whatever sentence it desired, 10 years on the remaining count. And if the defendant agreed, then obviously we would not be here. I'm not saying that it was that there was anything illegal at all about the plea process. It's way sooner when the motion to dismiss was filed. It's this similar to when there's a suppression motion filed. There doesn't make the plea process illegal in any respect. And in Hess, what the court was talking about was that there was something about that entire process that was illegal and that could not happen and could not ever happen again in the future. We're not talking about anything wrong with this plea process. There's been no attack on the plea agreement or any of the terms of the actual plea agreement. So we don't have an illegal plea process that we did in Hess.
Do you recall when the judge imposed sentence, how he weighed the aggravating mitigating factors? Do you know of him? Whether or not he found them mitigating, the aggravating, exceeding or
yes, Your Honor.
Was, go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, the court found no mitigating factors. It found as aggravating factors 3, 6, and 9, the risk that the defendant would commit another offense, the extent of his prior record, and the need for deterrence. And found no mitigating factors and that the aggravating factors preponderated.
So this goes to the question of the court's intent, because we're dealing with a second degree crime. And the lowest end is 5. The range is 5 to 10. The judge ultimately gave consecutive sentences, so we have a 10-year sentence. I mean, if the aggravating factors preponderate over the mitigating factors, you typically do not get a sentence at the lowest end of the range. Would you agree?
Well, when there's a plea, that would be a sentencing after a trial for sure. But when there's a plea agreement, anything is possible as long as the parties, the court was perfectly aware of the terms of the plea agreement. It was perfectly aware that this could be reversed on appeal.
Anything you'd like to add to your argument, Ms. Romeo?
Your Honor, I would want to point out something factual in that was raised by Judge Fuentes. Judge Fuentes recognized that in this case, the state could have charged the defendant with whatever other offense it believed was warranted based on the speed of the car. And I'd like to just point out that evidence was presented to the grand jury. So it is not the situation here where any of that was concealed or the state was prevented.
You just muted yourself by accident.
I'm sorry, I have a touchpad. We're not in a situation where that evidence of the speed involved in the accident, that was presented to the grand jury. So as Judge Fuentes pointed out, the state could have taken any other steps it wished to believe were warranted by that evidence. Thank you.
Mr. Levy.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and good afternoon, Justices. Being mindful of the court's docket and the schedule today, and the thorough arguments of Ms. Romeo before me, I'll keep my comments brief. The issue that I'd like to address is the legislature's decision to use the term another in Section 5.1 instead of any, as others have urged, would have meant something different. In a statute that relates to a fatal accident, it would have been imprecise for the legislature to use the term any, which would have been inclusive of the driver. So the legislature's decision to use another instead is to be more precise and clarify that the statute is only implicated when the person who died is another person besides the defendant. And this is consistent with the last sentence of paragraph A of Section 39 of the Motor Vehicle Statute, which states the term of imprisonment required by this section shall only be imposed if the accident resulted in death or injury to a person other than the driver convicted of violating this section. So the legislature's decision to use the term another does not necessarily reflect that they wanted to create single victim-based offenses, but it simply informs a decision to use more precise language and make clear that that it must be another person besides the defendant who was the fatality. Obviously, it would not make much sense to have a statute that would penalize a person who is dead as the result of the accident. There are no questions for the court. I would just rely on the arguments in my brief and request that the court affirm the appellate division's decision.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. Ms. Campbell, rebuttal?
Unless your honors have any questions, I'll submit on the arguments already made.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement.